I don't want to cut into Senator Hagel's time. We're very fortunate to have him, and one knows that on a Thursday afternoon it is very risky always to invite a senator. But, Senator, it's really a great honor to have you here. Everybody has the resume in their packet, but I really think we call this a view from the Hill, and if there's anybody in the entire Congress who can give us a view on the subject we've been dealing with today, it's Senator Hagel. And I think what the resume doesn't show is that I don't think there's, and I know this from when he first arrived, it's hard to believe that he's a freshman senator. He seems like he's more of a graduate student at this particular moment. It's only been 6 years. But when he came, everybody from David Roeder to George Will said this was going to be the leading figure, new figure in the Congress and in the Senate, and he has certainly turned out to be that. He has a background which doesn't show, which is a man who not only served in the military and combat in Vietnam, but worked on the Hill as a young man, managed to be in the public sector and really do very well in it in the profit-making sector, but also really worked in the nonprofit sector, and in addition, really knows the problems of the executive branch. I would, having served in the Reagan administration and the Veterans Administration, so I won't go through any more because I assume most of you know him. If you don't, you really should, and it's really a great honor for the Institute to have Senator Hagel. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, and I want to especially thank my friend Sandy Berger, who I always listened to, sometimes had to, actually. No, I never had to listen to Sandy, but I did, and I want to thank him for his courtesies, and Matt, it's nice to see you, and thank you all for allowing me an opportunity to be part of this conference. I am well aware of the speakers that you have had, and I'm a bit embarrassed that I find myself speaking last because I have some standards and expectations that are now placed upon me, as any last speaker does, and looking at the roster that you have been fortunate enough to hear today, I feel fully inadequate and unworthy, but being the shameless politician I am, I will try anyway. Thank you again for allowing me the opportunity to be here. As Max said, we may have a vote here in a few minutes, and I apologize for that, but the damn Tom Daschle is a problem, Sandy. I'm doing everything we can to change that, of course, but I know this is not a political rally. And I actually, Tom's a good friend, and he's a very effective leader. So I will present my offering, and if we are able to dodge this vote, I would be honored to participate with Sandy Berger in a Q&A session. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the attack on America on September 11th has forced us all to rethink America's role in the world, the meaning of individual and collective security, and the nature and urgency of the threats we now face. We are in the midst of historic and profound changes in world politics. The burdens of leadership today require an uncommon combination of strength, vision, and perspective. The 21st century offers great promise, but also presents great risks for the United States and those who look to us for inspiration and leadership. September 11th brought home clearly, painfully, the depth and complexities of the challenges of global American leadership. During the previous decade, American leadership relied heavily on riding the waves of the American economic miracle, maintaining our alliances, and managing regional conflicts that never touched our shores. That's a generality, but in essence, the great challenges were different. It was more a management of the issues than raw leadership. We now are faced with both in ample quantities that will require ample quality. Our success, prosperity, and potential over the years seemed to know no bounds. We marveled at the bull markets, American dominance of the information and technology revolutions, and heralded the benefits of American-led globalization. A wider lens view of the world reveals that in many ways the benefits of globalization may only be reaching those who read The Economist. Current economic and demographic indicators are a sobering reminder of the world that we must live in and lead, the real world that Americans may have tuned out or ignored over the years, a world that we did not wish to acknowledge. The UN World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg grappled with the challenges of poverty, disease, and the environment in the developing world. Today, out of a total world population of over 6 billion people, 5 billion live in the developing world, and the other 1 billion control 80% of the world's wealth. Half the world today lives on less than $2 per day. 40 million people are infected with HIV or living with AIDS, which is the leading cause of death in sub-Saharan Africa. By 2010, it is projected that 70% of the world's population, 4.2 billion by today's numbers, will have never made a telephone call. There will be 8 billion people in the world by 2025. Over the coming decades, these demographic and economic signs will foreshadow changes, major changes, in the nature of human society and international political alignments. As globalization has its discontents, America has its enemies. In the Middle East, the lack of open societies, democratic institutions, and economic development, as well as resentment of American power and policies, contributed to the rise of Al-Qaeda, its sponsors and its sympathizers. Radical politics, Islamic or otherwise, have their roots in political and economic despair. While Al-Qaeda should not be seen as representative of a general trend or tendency in the Islamic world, Al-Qaeda is still a major threat to all of us. We need to be aware of the complexities and the connections of the challenges we face, the need for positive, constructive initiatives that offer all people hope for a better world, and the implications of our policies for regional stability. Since and because of September 11th, the responsibilities and consequences of American leadership have widened. The American role is both inescapable and irreplaceable in shaping world politics. Our decisions today will have far-reaching global consequences tomorrow. President Bush has recognized that terrorism and weapons of mass destruction represent our greatest threats in the post-September 11th world. These threats are shared by our allies and the majority of the nations of the world. These common interests need not and should not be causes for division among our allies. America cannot defeat these threats alone. A recent UN report said that the Al-Qaeda International Financial Network is alive and well. U.S. and European officials this week cited the transfers of Taliban and Al-Qaeda gold through Pakistan to the Sudan to support their activities. The war on terrorism is a long-term endeavor which will require deep and wide levels of cooperation with many nations over many years in many areas: diplomatic, humanitarian, economic, trade, law enforcement, intelligence, and military force. We should not mistake our foreign policy interests for ideology in a rush to proclaim a new doctrine in world affairs. America must be steady. This brings me to the current debate about whether to go to war with Iraq and where it fits in our foreign policy priorities, given the world as it is today. Former Secretary of State George Shultz once said that foreign policy requires that, quote, we know that we are not omnipotent and that we must set priorities. We cannot pay any price or bear any burden. We must discriminate. We must be prudent and careful. We must respond in ways appropriate to the challenge and engage our power only when our very important strategic stakes are involved. End of quote. The war on terrorism must be conducted by engaging our power because the strategic and security stakes for America and our allies are so very high. President Bush has said that the United States must use, quote, every resource at our command, every means of diplomacy, every tool of intelligence, every instrument of law enforcement, every financial influence, every necessary weapon of war to the destruction and defeat of the global terror network. The President is right. But again, we can't do it alone. The President's point of using every tool, every means at our disposal to combat world terrorism means not just the military option, but all tools. Iraq cannot be isolated from our interest in supporting Arab-Israeli peace, helping to rebuild a dangerous and fragile Afghanistan, managing the volatile and dangerous situation in South Asia between India and Pakistan, and prosecuting the war on terrorism. Iraq is not Grenada, Panama, or Haiti. Iraq is a significant power in a region that is vital to the economic security of the United States, Europe, and Asia, and the geopolitical interests of the United States, Europe, and Asia. Taking action in Iraq cannot be considered in a vacuum. It is connected to all other vital American interests. I support the President's policy of regime change in Iraq, as was the past administration's policy. The Iraqi people have suffered too long, and the region's stability and America's interests will not be secure while Saddam Hussein has weapons of destruction at his disposal. But is the objective of our policy the removal of Saddam Hussein or the elimination of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction? This is one of the questions that my colleague, Senator Richard Lugar, and others continue to ask. It needs to be clearly answered. The President has begun to take the case against Saddam Hussein's Iraq to the American people, the U.S. Congress, and the world. This is the right approach. Many still have questions about whether Saddam's support for terrorism or Iraq's weapons programs present an urgent threat, requiring a unilateral, if necessary, American-led war effort to replace his regime. Saddam is a brutal tyrant and a regional threat. He cannot and will not be rehabilitated. But so far, America stands almost alone in the call for war against Iraq. Why should Iraq be a divisive issue in our foreign policy at home and abroad? It need not be. If we think it through and work the high road of diplomacy with our allies, as many experienced and highly respected Americans have suggested, we need to get back to the basics of diplomacy and develop an international consensus and coalition to deal with Saddam's weapons programs. It won't be easy, but this is the essence of effective policy. It is hard work, and it requires diligent effort, but it does pay off. As my colleague Dick Lugar again has said, quote, this heavy lifting should not be viewed as indicating a lack of American resolve or a hindrance to tactical military planning. To the contrary, it should be regarded as an opportunity to improve our relations with other countries, to ensure that we choose the right option regarding Iraq, to enhance our ability to respond to the spectrum of post-war contingencies, and to unify as a society through our traditions of public debate. Senator Lugar has it exactly right, as he does on most things. We need to reinforce UN resolutions and diplomatic initiatives both to get weapons inspectors back into Iraq, as President Bush has demanded, and to pressure and isolate Saddam's regime. We should strengthen our contacts with and support for Iraqi opposition groups operating inside Iraq, and encourage and facilitate contacts between the Iraqi opposition and the states of the region. We should also not be distracted by the expectations of dancing in the streets by Iraqis on the day they are liberated from Saddam's tyranny. This celebration will certainly take place, but we must prepare carefully to assure a democratic transition eventually, ultimately, in Iraq, and stability in the Middle East for the days, the weeks, and the years after Saddam is deposed. This will require patience and commitment and focus and discipline and allies. Absent a direct or imminent provocation or threat from Iraq, all these issues must be addressed before we move to a military option to change the regime in Baghdad. I can think of no major American foreign policy initiative that has succeeded without a coalition. The talk of going it alone betrays a fundamental understanding of foreign policy and a disregard for the democratic principles that should govern our conduct of foreign affairs. The world is ready to work with us when our cause is clear and just, as it was in the Cold War, the Gulf War, and Afghanistan. Very few questioned our right to wage war against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. It was not only our right, it was the responsibility of the United States to end that regime and the use of Afghanistan as a base for global terrorism. The world should not be against us on Iraq, and it will not be against us if we build the necessary international coalition based on respect for our allies, partnerships, common interests, and wise policy. Our engagement in the Middle East and the world must offer a vision of hope for a better day for all peoples, of the possibilities for economic prosperity and good governance, and not just hard-edged security calculations and doctrines. For those willing to walk with the United States down this new path, we must do so in a spirit of friendship and partnership, conditioned by a commitment to change and reform. This is especially critical in the Middle East, where democratic reform is the only answer to the politics of hatred, radicalism, and violence. The American role in the world requires a sophisticated realism tempered by an appreciation of American principles. I am reminded of George Washington's farewell address to the nation in 1796, when he advised that, quote, "Nothing is more essential than that permanent, inveterate antipathy against particular nations and passionate attachments for others should be excluded, and that in place of them, just and amicable feelings toward all should be cultivated. Harmony, liberal intercourse with all nations are recommended by policy, humanity, and interest." We are at one of those rare historic intervals when America's decisions as the world's leading power will have far-reaching and long-term consequences for world politics. After World War II, we also faced such a time. America responded with an ambitious and visionary plan to lead the rebuilding of Europe and Japan from the ruins of war. In announcing the plan, George Marshall said that, quote, "An essential part of any successful action on the part of the United States is an understanding on the part of the people of America of the character of the problem and the remedies to be applied. Political passion and prejudice should have no part. With foresight and a willingness on the part of our people to face up to the vast responsibility which history has clearly placed upon our country. Today, that responsibility for leadership has again fallen to the United States and to the American people. The challenges before us are great, but so is the potential for progress and an historic opportunity to help build a better world. This potential will not be fulfilled without American coalition building and strong partnerships of common interests. This is the world of the 21st century. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you.
I'd be glad to respond to